Welcome to the Democracy Dispatch podcast. I'm Justin Marsh, political director at Vermont Conservation Voters. This is your weekly scoop on legislative action as we work to push forward environmental policies for Vermont. Each Monday, we will take a look back at the week prior, preview the week ahead, and speak with legislators and advocates on topics affecting our air, water, open space, and quality of life. Happy Earth Day! On today's episode, we welcome back to the podcast two statewide elected officials and friends of the podcast. First, we'll hear from State Treasurer Mike Pichek, who discusses resilience investments in the Climate Superfund bill and the concept of a green bank and leveraging federal funds for climate initiatives. He also shares the initiative to create a baby bond program to break the cycle of poverty in Vermont. Then Secretary of State Sarah Copeland-Hansis joins for a conversation reflecting on her first year in the office, including the challenges of responding to flooding and building new IT systems. She discusses the future of ranked choice voting in Vermont and two upcoming forums on the topic. She also explores the possibility and concerns surrounding online voting and the use of artificial intelligence in elections. As she looks to the future, Secretary Copeland-Hansis highlights the importance of civic engagement and the ongoing efforts to promote civics education in Vermont. But before all of that, I want to bring in Lauren Hurl, Executive Director of Vermont Conservation Voters, for our session shakedown segment where we recap the last week in the State House and give a preview of what's in store. All right, Lauren, let's start out in the House. House Committee on Environment and Energy has been working on two bills brought to them by the Senate. We have S-259, Make Big Oil Pay, and S-213, the Flood Safety Act. What are the latest on those two bills?
Yeah, excitingly, both bills passed out of the House Environment and Energy Committee on really strong 9-2 votes. Both bills, you know, from our perspective, remained really strong. There were some kind of modest amendments to both. So House did their due diligence, worked through, made some key changes they wanted to see, but the substance really remained intact from, you know, doing what we wanted. So making Big Oil pay, having this, you know, first in the nation polluter accountability for the impacts of climate change. So that was really exciting to see that move forward. Some really impassioned speeches from some of the lawmakers about how important this is, given what Vermont communities are going through. And then, of course, flood safety, seeing this really watershed approach to how we're looking to reduce risk of floods. So just really exciting to see that progress. There was also one other bill that House Environment and Energy moved this week that we've been following. It was a miscellaneous Public Utility Commission bill, a bill that kind of started out as some technical corrections, but now has a couple pieces that we've been supporting all year, including looking at thermal energy networks. So this is kind of an efficient and evolving field of getting heating energy in like larger developments and stuff can take, or communities could take advantage of this type of technology. And then also a study on energy cost containment and really looking at, you know, how can we make our energy costs more equitable across the state? Since some people are paying a huge portion of their income, especially our lowest income Vermonters, just to stay warm and get around. So how can we kind of do better and have better programs to help people? So those were all exciting things that we were really glad to see move forward this week.
Yes. And over in the upper chamber, the Senate Committee on Natural Resources voted out H-687, the land use policy that makes changes to Act 250. What did the committee work on and add, and what other committees will have eyes on it before it goes to the floor?
Yeah, that bill, of course, has been very high profile, lots of moving pieces. So the committee, you know, worked through, it's a beast of a bill. There's a lot to it. And they pulled in pieces from S-311, which is a bill that the Senate Economic Development Committee had passed pretty early in the session with a number of provisions looking at how do we increase our housing stock. So this committee pulled in pieces of that. They also looked at things like, you know, one of the conversations has been around appeals if a project goes through Act 250 and it's getting appealed through the courts? Are there different ways to do that? So they kind of offered a compromise position on how the appeals process would work. And one of the other key things that they were looking at were short-term exemptions. So what are things as this, you know, new system is getting up and running, which will take time to do some of the mapping and get these this new system working? You know, how are we encouraging housing in the meantime? So the committee also kind of offered some increased exemptions around designated areas. So like our villages and town centers, to make it easier to build more housing and in a wider geography around those areas. So still maintaining those smart growth principles, but making it easier to build housing in the short term. So those were some of the key changes. The bill now is being looked at by the Senate Economic Development Committee that has a lot of interest in housing in particular. And I believe it will still need to go through the money committees and then head to the Senate floor. So I'm imagining we still have a bit of work in process and some ongoing negotiations, but I think some really good work, and there's a bill that I'm hoping they can still find that pathway to getting it actually enacted into law.
Yes, and they also have S-289, the Renewable Energy Standard, so that's come back to them now. What's the update on that bill?
The committee, Senate Natural Resources and Energy, has started looking at it as of the time that we're recording this. They're still working their way through it. From what we're hearing so far, it doesn't sound like there will be major changes from what the House passed. You know, you never know until the bill gets passed. But because that bill had been so kind of finely negotiated with a number of stakeholders through the House process, it's a hard one to, you know, pull a thread out of, and it can kind of disentangle the whole negotiation. So they're doing their work and their due diligence, but we're hoping to see action on that moving through soon.
And when folks are listening to this, it will be Earth Day, April 22nd, but the sand in the timer is certainly getting smaller. Do you think everything's going to make it across the line? What are your thoughts?
I'm very optimistic. I know that there's also pressure to wrap up the session and get out. I think May 10th is the official 18 weeks that they usually aim for. And to hit that deadline, there's a lot of bills that are going to have to move very quickly. So I think there will be a tension between trying to wrap up their work and make sure that these big priorities move. But given where we sit for the issues we've been talking about today, I think we're in good shape. And you never know what can happen. So we'll just have to keep everyone posted on how it continues to play out and if new wrinkles come up as we try to get through things over to the finish line.
Well, we will see what the next couple of weeks brings us. And you and I are going to be taking a break from the podcast for our little spring break. When things get down to the wire, I'm sure we'll have lots of updates in the weeks to come. So talk to you soon.
Yeah, have a great break.
You too.
Thanks.
Now let's hear Lauren's conversation with State Treasurer and friend of the podcast, Mike Pichek.
It is my sincere pleasure to be here today with Vermont's State Treasurer, Mike Pichek. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, no, thank you very much, Lauren, for having me. It's my pleasure to be here with you.
Great. Well, appreciate your time. I know it is super busy right now, but we've actually had a lot of opportunity to partner with your office on a number of initiatives that are really important to Vermonters. So wanted to update people on some of that work that's happening. So first, one of the things that I know your office has been spending a lot of time on is thinking about resilience investments and one specific policy that is looking at how do we collect some funds for that from the big fossil fuel companies, the Climate Superfund bill. So could you just share with our listeners a little bit about the Climate Superfund, but then also the broader initiative that your office is working on looking at the needs around resilience?
Yeah, no, happy to. I mean, you know, the Climate Superfund concept is one that I really immediately liked when I heard about it and was really excited that we could pursue it in Vermont, and have been even more excited about how much progress it's made this legislative session. You know, it's really a big concept, and sometimes you think it's going to take a little while, but we've made a lot of progress. And why I like it so much is because we know that the climate has changed in a way that is impacting Vermont now. It's getting warmer. It's getting wetter. We're seeing more severe rainfall. We're seeing more consistent rainfall. It's causing more flooding, and we're paying for that flooding in many different ways. So as we project out into the future, we know we're going to have more costs. We know we're going to have more damages. And who's going to bear those costs, and who's going to pay to repair those damages? Is it going to be Vermont taxpayers, or is it going to be industry and individuals that caused the climate to change and caused that impact to begin with? And I don't think it should be Vermont taxpayers. I think it should be the organizations, the corporations that caused the climate to change in the way that it is. So from the most fundamental basic level, I think it really spoke to me, and I know speaks to a lot of Vermonters. And when we could actually play a role in the bill, which will be to sort of calculate the damages that have occurred in Vermont due to climate change, and then project out the damages that will likely to occur and the resiliency work that will need to be invested in to make sure that we mitigate those impacts. It was something that we were really excited about and something we wanted to jump into, because it's just really, really creative work. And I think we'll have a real impact if we're successful on helping build that resilient future that we need. And you mentioned that resiliency work, and we did partner in early January with the administration to try to begin to calculate what is needed in terms of resiliency, what's needed in terms of wetlands, what's needed in terms of infrastructure, what's needed in terms of emergency response and communication, to so that when the next time we have an event like we did last summer, we'll be better prepared, we'll be able to mitigate some of the damages, and we'll be able to most effectively communicate with Vermonters as well.
Great. Yeah, such important work. And related but separate, I know your office has also spent quite a while looking at the concept of a green bank, or more broadly, how can Vermont make sure that we have the structures and systems in place that we can take as much advantage as possible, particularly of a number of federal funds that have become available through things like the Inflation Reduction Act and recent infrastructure law, as well as leveraging private investments as much as possible. So can you speak a little bit to what your office has been thinking about there?
Yeah, for sure. You know, in the first term as treasurer, we expanded this program called 10% in Vermont, and it went from having about $15 million or so invested to expanding it up to about $115 million is what we can invest in. And we focused on housing. We wanted to provide low interest loans to housing developers that were building affordable housing, senior housing, workforce housing, helping manufactured mobile home parks. So we really saw a lot of value and a lot of success with that. And we said, let's replicate this in the climate space. So we have a 2.5% credit facility that's working its way through the legislature that would allow us to do the same thing, partner with experts in the energy space and the climate infrastructure space, allow them to identify good projects to invest in that will make a big impact, and then we'll provide low-cost capital to them. So I really see that work, both on the housing front and the climate front, as the best parts of a green bank. You know, you're getting the value without having to create a new entity or a new organization. You're partnering with existing organizations. So we're going to continue to try to make that as successful as it can be, and then see if there are any gaps or any areas we need to, you know, think upon or improve upon. The other thing that we're doing, which I think is another critical piece of this, it's non-legislative, but in a couple of weeks, probably within the next 6 weeks, we'll be convening a climate roundtable with all climate finance professionals and organizations. And the goal of the roundtable is really to get everyone to understand what each other's working on, what pots of money they are working with, what pots of money are available at the federal level, as you mentioned, to make sure that the state, to make sure that local governments, that nonprofits, that the private sector is aware of all the opportunities that exist, and that everybody's pursuing as much as they possibly can pursue. So I think that climate finance roundtable will end up being something we do every 6 months or so to keep everybody engaged and informed and consistent with, you know, with each other.
So that's great. Well, having a treasurer thinking so hard and deeply about how we can be, you know, making the investments we need in climate action and climate resilience is so important and so appreciated. And before I let you go, any last initiatives that you want to share with our listeners?
Yeah, well, you know, we're continuing to support and advocate for the creation of a baby bond program here in Vermont. This is a program that would dedicate money to children born into poverty in our state. The treasurer's office would set that money aside. It would grow. And by the time those individuals become adults, they can use it to buy a house in Vermont, start a business in Vermont, go to school or job training, or into their retirement accounts. So we really see it as an opportunity to break this intergenerational cycle of poverty. It's an opportunity to enhance rural economic development, since so many of our impoverished children are born in more rural parts of our state, and trying to keep young people here in Vermont as well. So we're really excited about that. We're pushing for a pilot project and for a study, and we're going to work hard to make sure that we get that over the finish line this legislative session.
Well, that's great to hear. Thank you again for everything you're doing, and appreciate your time during this busy legislative session and all the other obligations you have. Thanks for joining me, and hope to have you back soon.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to be on the show.
Take care.
That was Vermont State Treasurer Mike Pichek. I'm joined now with Secretary of State Sarah Copeland-Hansis. Sarah Copeland-Hansis is from Bradford, Vermont, and is our 39th Secretary of State, transitioning into the role in 2023 after an incredible 18-year legislative career representing her Orange County district. She has spent almost her entire life in Vermont as a student of our schools, then an educator in our schools, a youth coach, a small business owner, a state legislator, and a mother and wife. She has served as majority House leader and as chair of the House Committee on Government Operations, certainly priming her for her role as Secretary of State. In the final biennium in the State House, she held a perfect 100 score from our organization and maintained a lifetime score of 91. Right. Welcome back to the podcast, Secretary Copeland-Hansis. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. So you're a year and a half into your role as Secretary of State, and I'm sure you can't reflect on your tenure thus far without thinking probably of the damaging flooding that your office encountered last summer. But play me sort of the highlight reel of your time in that role so far.
Well, you're right that the flood does factor pretty heavily in the work that we had to do during my first year. And it actually, I think in retrospect, was a good exercise in how we adapt and respond. We are in the midst of preparing for the 2024 general election. We don't know what that election will bring us in terms of people reacting aggressively or physically, lashing out at elections offices, as we've seen it happening in other parts of the country. So, you know, we've been exercising all of those relationships with the folks who helped us respond to a flooding emergency to sort of prepare for any what-if scenarios going forward. And, you know, highlights of the first year, you know, we are in the midst of building some new IT systems for our business services division, for our elections division. Obviously, we will wait to implement those until after the 2024 election, because we certainly don't want to disrupt anything right in the middle of elections. So 2024 has been busy, you know, building the plane while flying it. 2025 will be busy again in implementing a lot of those new IT systems. So it's been a lot of work and a lot of fun.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it. I want to shift to ranked choice voting now. S32, which included ranked choice voting for the 2024 presidential primary, made it out of the Senate last year on a vote of 23-7, but stalled out in the House. And now, obviously, Vermont has already participated in the presidential primary with the election a mere months away. But we saw ranked choice voting used in the Burlington mayoral race last month, as municipalities currently can use the method if they change their charter and go through the legislative process to do so. But there was language in S32 that would allow towns and cities to adopt ranked choice voting without having to do that added step. And what do you think the future of ranked choice voting for Vermont looks like?
Well, I love the fact that we've got ranked choice voting underway in our largest city, and that we have so far seen the people of Burlington have used it and understood how to do their voting and how to make their preferences, and have so far felt fairly satisfied with it. And so, you know, I think the future for us, you know, as far as I can influence it, because I can't decide what each municipality might want to do, but I would love to see us moving towards ranked choice voting for the presidential primary in 2028. And I've always said that the presidential primary is a great place to start with that statewide ranked choice vote option, because it is sort of the most discrete election of all of the elections that we have, because of the statewide ballots. There is just that one race on it, and as opposed to your primary or your general election, where there's federal races and there's local races and there's statewide races, and you know, switching back and forth between RCV and first past the post is really hard to do for the voter if it's different in different places on the ballot. So I'm looking forward to engaging in the conversation about moving towards RCV for 2028.
Awesome. And you're partnering with the Vermont League of Women Voters for two forums on ranked choice voting that are happening next month in May. Tell us about those two sessions.
So I'm really excited about this partnership. The League has been very supportive in helping us engage with Vermonters about what the move to ranked choice vote would look like and about how ranked choice voting works. And so they are helping us with the logistics and the outreach, and I'm so thankful to be able to talk about it here with you. So we're going to have a two-part fully virtual forum. In the first part, we're going to bring in a national RCV expert, you know, someone who can help us understand where it's used, how it's used, you know, sort of some of those bigger issues that have led other parts of the country to move towards ranked choice voting. We also are planning to do a sample vote that day. And so I think the plan at this point is to put together a fictional Republican and Democrat presidential primary ballot. So, you know, you and I both know that it's anybody's guess who will actually run for president 4 years from now. But we are going to put together a couple of fictional ballots with some well-known Republican and well-known Democrat names and give participants in these forums the opportunity to use a ranked choice ballot and then in real time to see how the results are coming out. You know, it is, I think, a powerful way of showing people that goes a little bit beyond, you know, sort of your standard, let's pick a pizza topping or let's choose the ice cream that we're going to have at our party. You know, I wanted it to be a little more focused on the political and on leaders. That's the first session. The first session is the sample vote and national RCV expert. The second session, which will be a week later, is going to be with two clerks from Vermont, one who currently has ranked choice voting, the Burlington clerk, and another who is familiar with ranked choice voting because she used to live in Maine. But her community does not currently have ranked choice voting. And, you know, the purpose of that conversation is really to acknowledge that ranked choice voting is going to be a fundamental change to the way, not only to the way that our clerks administer those elections, but also to sort of the timeline of when we can expect election results. Because when you go statewide and you have some communities that use tabulators, and some communities that still hand count ballots, you're not going to be hand counting and manually entering all of that information in order to do the ranked choice calculation. So it will involve some logistics, and I just want to engage the clerks in helping people understand that, you know, that we've got some very careful considerations because we certainly don't want to jeopardize the security of our elections or make life that much more difficult for our local election administrators who will be helping us to conduct these elections.
Yeah, I remember last year hearing the testimony from the Maine Secretary of State on ranked choice voting. And it was definitely, it's, you know, obviously Maine and Vermont have a lot of similarities in our geography and our demographics, but it'll be interesting to hear. That's the Brattleboro town clerk you were referencing, yes. Right? Hillary Francis. So that'll be really fascinating to see someone who has the experience in Maine, but then also knows now how we kind of function here in Vermont and with our municipalities. So that'll be fascinating. I can't wait to hear that. And I'll provide details for listeners after my interview. But yeah, that's exciting. I'm really pumped for those sessions. I was recently at a state summit for America Votes down in Washington, D.C. And at the end of the conference, we were all asked to scan a QR code and take a survey that happened in real time. And as the results sort of were coming in, they were tabulated and put on a screen, sort of a word bubble. And the question that we were asked was, where do you see elections in 20 years? And the top results were all versions of either online or internet voting. And it had me thinking, you know, what are your thoughts on elections in 20 years? And do you think we'll be voting online anytime soon?
Yeah, that's such a fascinating question. And I really like to ponder that. What does it look like in the future? What are the big new ideas that we could be looking at in a couple of decades? And you know, it is hard sometimes when you're in your first term in office and the first presidential election you're overseeing to sort of look beyond the immediate challenges. So I just want to give a quick nod to the immediate challenges. You know, I already talked about the building the new election management system while we're still flying the old one and, you know, the rollout of that next year. There are some other issues that I think are fairly pressing that we need to grapple with in terms of immediate concerns. The issue of artificial intelligence in elections, whether that be in promoting believable election misinformation or whether that is, you know, falsely passing information about where people should be voting or even impersonating a candidate and trying to skew elections that way. We've got some immediate work we should do to make sure we've got some safeguards in place about AI in campaign communications, et cetera. And then sort of the next place my brain goes with respect to, you know, these sort of far off issues is, what are other places doing, right? I know that there are some countries that use electronic voting, that, you know, where people are able to access their ballot with their mobile device and submit their ballot in that way. That to me seems like a really amazing opportunity to give real convenience to people to be able to vote. But in this era of people spewing misinformation about stolen elections, I do also worry that if we don't have some significant safeguards in terms of data privacy and in terms of security, that we could throw a wrench into the faith that people have that their democracy is well run. And so I'm certainly open to continuing to ask the questions, kick the tires, you know, look at the ideas, see what other countries have done and what are the security measures that they have in place that maybe we don't. And, you know, we should always be looking for ways to make it easier for people to vote securely.
Yeah, it will be fascinating to see what develops and even just the next decade when it comes to that. And I think it obviously, as you mentioned, there's a lot of, you know, threats to electronic voting. And I also think it opens up a lot of opportunity as well. I think about, you know, people being able to use their devices and having automatic translation right on in the palm of mm-hmm. their hand, rather than making sure that we have, you know, those, you know, ballots and also election material
at every single polling place. It's just, I think from an accessibility standpoint, the opportunities are pretty amazing, but of course there's a long way to go. Speaking of, you know, down the road and everything, I know you have not made any formal announcements about your bid for re-election, but earlier you did mention 2025. So I want to know, what are some things that excite you about the future of democracy in this great state of ours?
There are so many wonderful things about being the chief elections administrator in a state like Vermont. You know, we started a civics program when I first came into office, and our education and civic engagement work is really ramping up. It's been very exciting to get out to middle schools and high schools, and even I've been to a couple of elementary schools to start engaging with kids. We've got a great teacher advisory group who is helping to sort of curate and even create civics materials that teachers can use in their classroom. And we are also embarking on Vermont's first ever Civic Health Index, which is basically an opportunity to bring together many, many different data points and data sources and a couple of surveys of Vermonters so that we can get a really good look at who's participating in democracy, who is active in their community, who volunteers on a board or regularly helps out their neighbor, you know, sort of the broad view of what civics is. And I really expect that when that information comes in and our Civic Health Index is complete, that that's going to give us sort of a roadmap of where we go in the coming years to really engage Vermonters. Because, you know, when I talk about civics, I remind people that civics isn't just about, you know, can you recite the Bill of Rights or do you understand the concept of checks and balances? Civics is about, do you know how to ask your government to do something for all of us that you can't accomplish acting on your own as an individual? You know, do you know how to organize and petition your government to fix a problem? And to me, that's the most powerful skill that anyone can have living in a democracy. And I want to make sure that more Vermonters understand that.
Well, hear, hear, and hopefully we will have you back next biennium as our Secretary of State. Secretary Copeland Hanses, thank you so much for your time today.
It's very nice to be here. Thanks.
The League of Women Voters' first Ranked Choice Voting Forum is scheduled for Wednesday, May 1st from 7 to 8:30 on Zoom. The second forum will take place on Wednesday, May 8th from 7 to 8:30 on Zoom. The latter session will dive into the details of administering ranked choice voting elections in Vermont, featuring Burlington Assistant City Clerk Sarah Montgomery and Brattleboro Town Clerk Hillary Francis. You can register for those at leagueofwomenvotersofvt.org, but it's shortened, so it's lwvofvt.org. That's lwvofvt.org. I want to thank our guests, Secretary of State Sarah Copeland Hanses, State Treasurer Mike Pichek, and Lauren Hurl for assisting me. If you enjoy this podcast, please subscribe and give us a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts, and be sure to follow us on social media. You can subscribe to our emails, see our legislative environmental scorecard, and learn more about our work and policies by visiting VermontConservationVoters.org. We will be on spring break next week, but we'll be back in the thick of it upon our return with another new episode slated for May 6th. Until then, thanks for listening.